the wrong button. Yes, I did. Good morning, everybody. We'd like to call the Board of Directors Budget and Finance Committee meeting to order and ask for a roll call, please.
On the roll for the Budget and Finance Committee meeting of March 22nd, 2017, Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Chavez.
Here.
Director Joya. Director Hudson.
Here.
Director Miley. Director Mitchell.
Here.
Director Ross. Committee Vice Chair Rice.
Here.
Committee Chair Groom.
Present.
Chair Nis.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. We'll now stand and pledge allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now is the time for public comment. Do we have any public comment cards, Madam Clerk? Okay. Thank you. And ask for approval of the minutes of February the 22nd.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Abstentions? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I actually do have one card. Susan
right.
Gustafson.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether this goes on unagendized, whether it goes on budget or fees, but it certainly is applicable to all. Susan Gustafson, I still work for Valero. I wanted to bring your attention to something. I love math, and I'm an engineer, and the thing that I love about math is it provides kind of simple answers to complex or difficult questions. I did an analysis recently on presentation the district put forward last year during the Reg 3 fees workshop. And so I ran some calculations, and I thought that it was relevant to the decisions that you're making here with the budget and then also with Reg 3 fees, as it has to do with cost control and cost containment. In fiscal year 2013, the district's cost recovery was 80%. In 2016, the Reg 3 fee workshop presentation stated that the district's cost recovery goal was to increase cost recovery to 85% over 4 years, from 2013 to 2016. During this same time, refinery sector fees increased on an average between 7 and 9%. This was in addition to two refinery sector fee increases, Schedule W and Schedule X, which were approved last year, and some other adjustments to internal existing fee schedules. So, interestingly, from calendar year 2013 through 2016, the consumer price index averaged about 2.7% per year. So, theoretically, fees should have at least kept up with that, or fee increases, or budget increases should have kept up with that. Assuming those district cost increases match the consumer price index, that would have averaged a little over 11% over 4 years. Interestingly, though, the refinery or the large industry sector fees were an additional 4 to 6.3% above that for a cumulative increase of 23% above what the consumer price index was. And so recently, the recent presentation for Reg 3 fees and the cost recovery gap was that there was only a 2% increase in that cost recovery gap. It went from 80% to 82%. And it seems like filling a 5% gap over 5 years with the large cost increases, it should have been able to be filled, but there's still a pretty big gap there. And so that was only 2% higher than the cost recovery of 80% in 2013. So the reason that I bring this up is that, of course, fees affect all of us. They affect industry, which directly... It affects industry, which indirectly affects all of us because we all buy goods and services from industry, but it also affects all of us individually as taxpayers because each of us pay a certain percentage of our taxes to the air districts so the air district can do their job. I bring this back because time. I really feel that the... Did you say time?
Yeah, go ahead and finish up.
Thank you. That I really feel that the cost recovery and the cost containment and the fee increases and the work that you guys are working so hard to do needs to be put together in one document so that all of this is transparent so you can do a better job for all of us. Thank you.
Get your comments. Yeah, we've done that. We approved the minutes. So now we'll go to the main event here, which is a discussion of the proposed budget for fiscal year ending 2018.
Thank you, Chair Groom, members of the committee. I will be addressing some of the comments that were made here earlier near the second half of my presentation. Today is the first of two presentations of the fiscal year ending 2018 budget to this committee. The next presentation will be in about 1 month. Sorry, just a moment while I get my technology working. So I'm going to first be discussing the status of the current year, which fortunately is pretty much on target, so that's a brief conversation. Then I'll talk about the proposed budget for 2018. And at the end of that, I'll go into related detail on reserves and unfunded liabilities and our strategies on how to deal with that, and then outline the next meetings that will occur. So for the current year, fortunately, I can get through the current year pretty quickly because the revenues are on target. Our property taxes, our permit fee revenues on target, property tax revenue a little higher than we projected, and our expenditures are on track in a $78 million budget. And before I move to 2018, let me again, as we usually do, set a little historical context. For the conversation, during the downturn, took a series of actions, including reducing, using our reserves to get through that time, and since then have been able to bring our reserves back up to a more comfortable level. The guidance from the board on our minimum reserves is 20% of our general fund revenue, and in the past that was actually 15%. And in the past, of course, our general fund revenue was less than it is now. So during the downturn in 2011, we just touched what was at that time the board minimum and have since that time increased our reserves. I do want to continue, as before, to set context, even though the downturn initiated in 2008, to point out that what we had to do back then still affects us today. We tried to take many different gradual measures to deal with the economic downturn. We certainly did use our reserves. We drew them down. We also stopped hiring, and we let attrition increase our number of vacancies, reduce staffing. We put off a lot of expenditures. We deferred a lot of capital expenditures, which was relatively easy as we were hoping to leave the building. And fortunately, with the board's guidance, we initiated a cost recovery policy for our fees, which I'll discuss in some more detail later. But throughout the downturn, we continued to fund our retirement liabilities, which worked out very well because it meant we were funding them at the bottom of the market. So that was a good thing. So now, let me turn now to the 2018 budget. This is a $94.8 million general fund budget. $8 million of that, however, is not from property tax or other revenues, but rather from a use of reserves. This budget does incorporate continuation of the cost recovery policy increasing fees, which Jamie, our director of engineering, will talk about in more detail in the next presentation, but I'll also go into it a little bit. We're increasing our staffing level by 12 people to accommodate many of the new challenges that we're taking on. We also, with this budget, continue to proactively address our retirement liabilities. And although our negotiations for contract are still pending, we have included in the budget an assumption of a continuation of the current contract, which would be a 2.7% cost of living increase. Excuse me. So in this budget, we've got about half of our revenue from permit fees, about a third from property tax, the remainder from other sources. That 10% miscellaneous includes that $8 million pull-in from reserves. Our expenditures, 50% salaries, about 10% pension and OPEB, the remainder service supply and capital, about a third service supply. Again, historical context. We reduced our expenditures from 2010 through 2013 and then have gradually been increasing them over time. Please notice that there is one unique expenditure indicated there, which is the Beale Street down payment of $9 million. And 2010 through 2015 are our actuals. 2017 is the adopted budget. 2018 is what is proposed today.
Madam Chair, what do you mean by capital? I'm just trying to figure out from this slide.
So capital expenditures are for items that technically large items that can be depreciated, equipment with a long lifetime,
okay.
Investments in our building, that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Our Director of Engineering, Jamie, will go into the proposed fees in detail. I'll just touch briefly on this. This is the sixth year where the fees are being adjusted based on a cost recovery policy. Prior to the existence of this policy, we revisited the topic anew every year. It was a difficult process. Fortunately, now we have this policy in place, which gives us a target of 85% cost recovery. We are enabled by our enabling legislation to recover 100% of our costs through our permit fees. Our recovery actually got down into the 60% region in the past, which is a difficult place to recover from. So in what Jamie will talk about, there will be a 6.4% fee increase, as has been sort of our standard for the last several years. And he'll talk about how we're doing getting towards 85%. I want to point out that there's both a numerator and a denominator in a percentage, and therefore, as we increase our the number of projects we're taking on, increase our staffing, then the amount of permit revenue that we need to cover those costs increases. And so it is possible to increase our fees. And if we're trying to recover our staffing back to where it was before the downturn, then you know it takes some time to get to 85%. In the past, we did have some strong involvement from the regulated community when we revisited the manner in which we calculate our cost recovery. And although we recalculate our cost recovery, do that study every year internally, we now have an RFP out to once again have an external financial not an auditor as such, but a professional organization come in and help us in conjunction with the regulated community look at how we calculate our cost recovery and what we're doing to keep our costs in line. So. We're increasing our positions by 12 to 359 in this proposed budget. This details the place, the divisions in which we are asking to increase our headcount. In addition, we have some new reserve designations. Let me talk a little bit about what these are. These are not expenditures that are being pulled into the budget. These are merely line items in the reserves. They are meant to communicate to the board what we hope to do in the future, but we would have to come back to the board in order to pull these out of reserves. So when I get to the reserve slide, you'll see each of these items as a line item.
Mr. McKay, on the 12 positions, do these include positions for the new technology wing, or are they in a different part of the budget?
They do.
Okay.
Yes.
All of them or just some of them?
I'll ask Mr. Breen to...
We are currently, it's already built in. We're taking existing positions that you've already given us and transferring them over there. So the positions that you see here, principally in engineering and information services, are to support the refinery work that we're doing. And a lot of these positions are actually related to that.
So the new technology division or whatever has its own positions someplace else?
Yes. We had an existing position, and we had three existing positions we're transferring over there. And in the budget, we have some more funding to hire more. We're starting out by hiring the officer itself and then letting them staff it. So as projects come in, we'll be coming back to the board, I think, for additional staff as projects and the office itself develops a little bit better.
Additional dollars to the budget or existing dollars that are in the budget?
Additional staff positions, the dollars are already in the budget.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please.
Yeah, this is sort of related. It goes back to slide 7 when you're talking about the general fund budget. And what I wanted to know, because the 94.8 million is an enormous increase over last year. And how much of that is for going to be ongoing costs? How much of it is one time versus one time?
So 8 million of that is the pull in from reserves.
Okay.
So that accounts for a large amount of the increase. And then one time costs include. For instance, the capital items.
I guess what I'm most interested in is the ongoing. How much of the increase in terms of our total budget? So we've got an increase in revenue of significant, which is a combination of several different things, right?
Right.
Two of them, I would guess, both our fee revenue and property tax are directly related to the economy, right?
That is true.
So what I'm getting at is I'm concerned about our ongoing expenses growing. So I really want to understand the ongoing expenses growing and how much those are linked, or if the economy slides, where are we to be at in terms of having added on personnel? And I know we need the staff to do the work, but I just, so that's my question. Because I do see that we had a huge bump in revenues, and a big part of it was because of this economy.
It's a very relevant question, absolutely. And in particular, the way in which Director Rice, you set it up, talking about one-time expenses versus ongoing expenses. So we're very careful to...
So
we're very careful to only match increases in personnel to expected increases in ongoing revenue. So that means property tax especially, but also permit fees, as opposed to use of reserves, which we use only for one-time expenses. And in particular, you can see those one-time expenses in the capital items, but also you'll see an increase in professional service supply that's related to the pull-in from reserves, which is, which I'll talk about in a bit, is a large part of which is support for the Clean Air Plan.
So. Chair Nish, did you have a question? Yeah, I actually have two, and I would have reflected just as Director Rice did. I would urge us to have good answers to that, because as the current word being optic, I now I've heard a new word, which is cosmetics, which is kind of interesting. But looking at this, you're saying 78 to 94, correct?
That's correct, but 8 million of that is a drawout from reserves. So that's one time. Yeah.
Right, but no matter what it's from, the public doesn't really pay a great deal of attention to that. What will play out in the press is huge jump in budget for Airboard. So I would urge us to have very concrete answers, and and Jack's probably the one most likely to be answering those. So if you would both think about that. And so also, how close are we to hiring somebody for this technology position? Are you calling it IT? Do you have it? Is that your?
No, Technology Implementation Office. The position closes on the 24th, and we've got quite a few applications. So we are not going to drag too long after that.
Good.
It'll be within
Good.
The next
okay.
couple of weeks.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Director Mizell.
Thank you. Along that line, since the Technology Implementation Office is from reserves one time, we want that to continue going on. Are we always going to be looking at reserves to fund that?
The idea is to use the reserves to create a revolving loan fund or a revolving
That's
grant
right.
fund.
Okay.
So that will bring in revenue. Which will hopefully have administrative fees associated, and that's how we tend to support
thank you.
That.
I'm sorry, I did remember you mentioning that
yeah.
in the past. And then you don't have to go back to it, Jeff, but on slide 11, 12 of those positions are executive. 12 of those new positions, two of them are executive.
Yes.
Is one of them the technology implementation officer? Or that's one of the questions that always comes up. I have no problem adding to it, but I'm just curious what those positions are.
So, Director Mitchoff, we took the technology implementation officer was a director position that was vacated, so we retitled it basically and created the technology implementation officer. The other position, the other executive position, is actually the health officer.
The health officer, okay. Mm-hmm. So when it says information services one, that is not the executive or the TIO.
No, that's additional staff to make sure that we get the work done to make our refineries come into our new production system.
Great. Okay,
this
thank
year.
You.
So
that's fine. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Okay.
So, let me make a distinction now between two different discussions of reserves I'm providing here. I described in the previous slide. New designations within our reserves, and those are not funds that we are pulling into the budget. When I show the table for reserves, those funds will still be shown as in reserves. We're just going through the process of alerting the board that we will come back in the future to seek monies in approximately those amounts. However, there's also the $8 million that I referenced in the beginning that we're actually pulling out of reserves and into this budget. And those are for the following four items. $4.5 million of that is for the implementation of the Clean Air Plan, almost $2 million for meteorology equipment, $1 million because in engineering we've got a lot of work to do with these new health risk assessments, and $650,000 for the Technology Implementation Office immediately. I'm going to talk about the detail on two of these, but let me point out that the board's approval of these items in the budget does not constitute approval for these expenditures. It just means they're in the budget, and they still have to come back to the board for approval of any contracts. So the
I'm
first
so sorry. You need to go back. The $650,000 is from what you're proposing from the almost $8 million this year, but in the previous two slides, you mentioned $3.4 million. I get what I heard you say is from now on they'll be designated in reserves in the budget. So are we getting more money, 3.4 plus 6.5, or is 3.4 part of that 6.5?
Right. So I'm showing to the committee here two different uses of reserves. One, in the first slide that you're referring to, where there's $3.4 million for the TIO, that's where within the reserve designations, you will see that that's still in reserves, and we've designated it for the TIO. We're not pulling it out into the budget. $650,000 is no longer in reserves. It's been pulled in as revenue to give us a balanced budget in this year. And so that 650, you will no longer see in reserves.
But I go along with Director Nish. There's going to have to be an easier, better way to explain that to the public. It's very difficult to assimilate.
That's a very good point. Thank you. I think in subsequent presentations, we can distinguish between revenue and expenditures more explicitly that are from reserves versus those that are from ongoing revenue.
Yeah, as we said, if I may just finish up on that, I think the easier we can make it for the reader to understand that this looks like a jump of, how's my math, is it 14 million? Just looks weird.
Yes, so make it clear that 8 million
of
that is
reserves. I can't think of a better word, right?
Yeah, thank you. So, although, as I mentioned, it's not our intention here to approve expenditure of these funds, just to put them in the budget, and it's not our intention to approve specifically what these implementations mean, I'll just revisit these slides that we showed in the previous Budget and Finance Committee presentation about clean air plan implementation, pulling in $4.5 million to establish a grant program, and $1.7 million in meteorology equipment, which Eric Stevenson would be happy to talk about in detail if there are any questions. Let me turn now to our reserves.
Jeff, yeah. If I can help for a little bit here, because having been here for a while, I've lived through some times with a number of you on the board where, I don't know if you all recall, when the state of California wanted to be able to go after some of the cities and counties, and so folks really started to try to figure out how to categorize their reserves for fear that they might be actually reached in and pulled out. We had those kinds of discussions. We found that unless it's encumbered, basically, it's basically all as part of the reserves. So what we ultimately ended up doing is deciding to go down a path where we would designate them as to be as clear as possible to say, we're going to set these things aside. The board is making a decision that this is the kind of money we're going to use for these programs, but it's not encumbered, if that helps. It's still part of a bigger pot of reserves, if it helps you to give some historical context.
Well, yeah, and I just think it's very important that they be titled, and we've done that.
Thank you. And I do have the detailed reserve slide coming up. Let me talk first about the policy. The policy is that we, as a minimum, have 20% of our general fund budget in reserves. In the current budget, if we exclude the use of fund balance, that is the use of reserves, then that's a $17 million minimum. To the point that was made earlier, the budget that does not use reserves is only $87 million. If we expend the entire $8 million fund balance, then that brings our projected reserves down to $31 million, which includes the remaining building sale proceeds. So we're comfortably above the 17. Now here's our opportunity to go through this in some detail. So first of all, I'll start at the top with the designated fund balances. Let me point out that as the asterisk indicates, these are entirely subject to change by the board. From our auditor's perspective, they don't have a meaning. They're a planning tool, if you will. They're the manner in which we remember from year to year where and in what amount we have funds that we might wish to use for large projects. You'll see there that we've added, as I discussed earlier, $500,000 for anticipated litigation, $150,000 for the woodchip program, $100,000 for the new workplace development and diversity program, which I think actually that's a down-level name. I think we've got a different name for that. And $1 million for WITSMUC grants. So our total designated reserves are now almost $27 million, with the very first line in the designation being that 20% guidance for minimum economic contingencies. Given our use then of almost $8 million from undesignated reserves, that leaves our total undesignated fund balance at zero. And there is, as Mr. Brabant indicated, a good reason for us wanting to designate all of our reserves. In addition to that $27 million, we have almost $5 million still in building proceeds after we pay down the $9 million for this building. I don't have any detail on that today, but at some point in the future, as has been discussed, we may bring forward to the board the idea that we would spend another $4 million out of those building proceeds to acquire another 10,000 square feet within this building. So if we add those together, we've got,
Stop it. You would spend another how much? $4 million?
$4 million for 10,000 square feet.
Okay, and that's cash purchase.
That would be a complete, that would be a subsequent transaction to our original purchase, unrelated. It would be a cash purchase, not financed, and it would be at the original cost for furnished square footage of $385 per square foot.
Okay, thank you.
So that's a comfortable fund balance, but I think it's appropriate also on this slide to indicate our total unfunded liabilities, which, based on the 2015 actuarial valuation, is about $92 million. And realistically, depending on one's actuarial assumptions, although we have been putting money in, we probably should not assume that that is any smaller. So this is the detail picture of our current proposed fund balance. It's got the 5 million new designations and reserves scattered there throughout the designation elements. For the undesignated, you see a use of fund balance of the $8 million that's coming into the budget. And that leaves us with $31 million. I'd like to talk now about CalPERS pension. Okay. This can actually be a rather large conversation. We, according to CalPERS, in 2015, were 78% funded, and that leaves $60 million unfunded. The board has put in place a funding policy of 90% without a target date. In the current budget, we are proposing an additional pre-fund beyond what CalPERS requires from us of $1 million, which is an increase from the prior year. Let me talk a little bit about some detail behind that. Historically, we've been concerned with CalPERS performance. If you look here from 2009 to 2015, S&P increased by about 17% every year. There's only one year where CalPERS outperformed the S&P, one year where it was equal and it was below the rest of the time. We would have done better just putting our money in some S&P tracking fund. In addition, we don't necessarily agree with CalPERS' rate of return assumptions, and the rate of return assumptions are what lead them to their conclusion that we're 78% funded. We think that might be a little bit optimistic. If you look at 2016, I think the S&P was up 10%. CalPERS was up 0.6%. This is not encouraging. And CalPERS will now lower its projected rate of return over several years. There are a lot of assumptions there that could be questioned, but the bottom line is that their required contribution from us will go up. And I have a detail slide here on that. I won't try to go through this slide. We'll not try to go through all of this slide. It's meant somewhat as a resource, but the important point is if you look at the yellow row, right now the required contribution from us is $6 million, and for fiscal year ending 2023, it's almost $13 million. So that's a $7 million increase, which is approaching 10% of our general fund budget. So it's pretty significant increase, and therefore We do think it's entirely appropriate to be putting aside an additional million in the current year. Now, that opens the question of where do we put that million? We do not need to obtain a final board direction within the budget process for where we put that money. It can be done as a subsequent conversation because it could be an extended conversation depending on the degree to which the board wishes to get involved in our diversification of reserves. An obvious place for that money is the public agency retirement services, which it's possible other of your organizations are using. In this year, we would be putting in $1 million, but as I said, we can put it aside and choose if PARS is the target for that or not at a later time. PARS is relatively new. They have about 250 clients, both for OPEB and for pension, and we would bring forward, if the committee wishes, a more detailed conversation in the future. But, of course, if the committee is familiar with PARS and feels that that is the likely appropriate target, we can go ahead and fund PARS. We can always pull that money out, but fortunately it cannot be used for anything other than its designation of pension or OPEB. If the committee were to want to proceed with this, then we would at the next committee meeting bring forward a resolution for the board, which would go to the board in May, and then approval of funds to the trust would be in June. But again, it is not necessary to move at that speed.
I'm sorry, Jeff, would you go back? Because there was a second option. One more. The pre-fund pension, or is that just part of PARS? It looks like a separate option.
Thank you, Director Mitchoff. That's not clear in this slide. The Pension Rate Stabilization Trust Fund is PARS.
Thank you.
Yep. So our other unfunded liabilities are OPEB. I'll start with the happy slide. This is the slide that shows that, fortunately, some time ago, even though times were rough, we decided we had to start putting one foot in front of the other on this topic, and we started funding OPEB. It was not required and is not required that we fund it. And we made some progress. As you can see from the slide, we've gotten close to a 50% funding at this point. And in 47% funding, leaving $33 million unfunded still. There is a policy in place from the board, 90% funding level. There's not a target date for that. In the prior year, that's the year we're in right now, we pre-funded by $3 million. With this budget, we're proposing to pre-fund by $4 million. And we will have the opportunity, if we wish, to diversify that investment from CalPERS to PARS, should we choose to.
Back to slide 30. We need a definition of AAL. I think you had it somewhere, but what's AVA and MVA?
I apologize. I missed some acronyms there. So the AAL is the actuarially accrued liability. In other words, how much we would have to have in the bank.
Is that the same as an unfunded?
That's the unfunded liability.
Okay, because I come from a 1937 Act county, and we use it as UAL. It's okay. I just want to make sure I'm thinking along the same lines.
So the light blue is what we would need in the bank to cover our retirees, and the light green is what we would need in the bank
for the if
everyone who's currently here retired today.
And so AVA and MVA means?
If I was not using a graphic I can't modify, I would have put only one of those in. One of them is actuarial valuation, the other is market valuation. They're essentially identical.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. So $4 million in the proposed budget to pre-fund OPEB.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry? So $1 million to pre-fund CalPERS. And CalPERS, we are required to fund CalPERS every year. We're suggesting an additional $1 million beyond the $6 million. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Is the four, so was it going to be 3 plus 1 or it's 4 plus 1? What's the $4 million represent?
So we're not required to pre-fund OPEB at all.
I get that, but you're saying in the budget.
Can I answer the question?
So what we're suggesting is that we pre-fund OPEB by 4 and add additional funding to CalPERS by 1. So that's 5 for CalPERS, 4 for OPEB.
Thank you.
Wait. That's 6, isn't it? You have the 1 million that you're required.
Do I say 5?
1 million additional and 4 million open.
Sorry, thank you.
Director Rice would like to ask. Director Rice would like to ask a question.
But I'm patient. I'm very patient. But anyway, you made a comment at the very beginning of your presentation around when we began pre-funding, I think, OPEB.
Yes.
And you said, I think you said something we were, and as it turned out, it was at the bottom of the market.
Right.
Which to me said that was a good thing because.
Absolutely.
So I'm just, and I know we're not supposed to be playing the market here as we talk about this, but I'm just wondering if you could comment on the timing of us pre-funding when we have such a bull market going, and if we had another option potentially that, I don't know, I'm just that comment stood out to me.
It's a very good point. It's the topic of diversification in an agency that has very limited options for diversification. So fundamentally, our options are San Mateo, which does a great job of keeping our money safe, our capital, but isn't able to give us options to beat the market, so to speak. Our other option is CalPERS, which has some ups and downs in its history regarding its ability to invest properly. There's the option of PARS, which gives us a few more options for investment. It's still relatively conservative, but not as conservative as going San Mateo. And, of course, real estate is effectively another option for us. And we have gone that route, certainly with this building. We've discussed the idea of bringing forward another $4 million into the building. We bring that forward to the board possibly in the future. We did buy a parking structure just a few blocks from here for about $3 million 2 years ago, I think, possibly a year and a half ago. And that also is probably a good diversification. If one looks at our line item for rents, we do rent quite a few small spaces around the Bay Area, because for meteorology and other equipment, and also for our compliance enforcement folks, it's possible that a purchase would be a better option than rent for some of those as well. So we have taken some steps towards diversification. Using PARS would be another step in that direction. Possibly going real estate would be another step. In general, right now, all assets seem to be high. So where to put money is an issue.
And or the timing of when you drop it into the market.
Absolutely, right.
Director Ross. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might be biased towards real estate, but I am. Well, I tell stockbrokers, you know, that's why they call it real estate. Light industrial inventory in the Bay Area is going, which is presumably the type of space we would mostly need out in the field and that we're renting, is going to be unfortunately very, very diminished as we go forward, as it's converted to residential, and as it becomes less and less, as more residential comes in, the neighboring light industrial becomes more of a nuisance, and so on and so forth. So it is a thought that for that type of space, it's an excellent investment because it will become a problem for the Bay Area that it's being overlooked, in my mind, but something we might want to consider because it is a fungible asset and will become much more valuable than office space will.
Thank you, Director Ross. Yes, so really appreciate that perspective, and that would support what we're currently investigating, which is the possibility of an East Bay purchase, which it's not yet time for us to talk about in detail with the committee. But it also supports our purchase of this garage space here, which is very close to South Park area, which is being refurbished. And it's not residential, to your point. So without getting too speculative in the real estate market, we feel like we're doing some appropriate diversification there.
Uh,
So in this building, we have signed the purchase option on the lease, and closing should happen in April. That means we're putting down $9 million. That reduces our obligation to $21 million. We have very favorable terms on that $20 million, which I've discussed in some detail. I won't go into now. Our mortgage payment, it's technically not a mortgage, but it will be $100,000 a month approximately. In addition, we'll have condominium expenses, which we'll be reviewing with this committee on a regular basis. And as I've discussed, we may bring forward the possibility of a subsequent purchase. To summarize, we have a budget that is balanced. It uses $8 million in reserves, and to the very good point that's been made, we'll distinguish more carefully going forward between the amount of that budget that is coming from reserves and the amount that's coming from revenue. We're increasing our positions by 12 to 359. We're increasing our contribution for OPEB from $3 million to $4 million, and we're increasing our optional funding for CalPERS to $1 million, which could go to a PARS pension trust, and that could be decided in the future. This is the first of two public hearings. In April, we'll have the second hearing, and at that time, ask the committee to refer the budget to the board, and the board's meetings are in May and in June. And that's my presentation. I'll be happy to take any more questions.
Let me ask first if there are folks on our committee who would like to explore the PARS option. The PARS option.
Let's do that.
Okay. So we would like, Cindy, go ahead.
That's good. I just want to ask an additional question.
Okay. Let's plan for our next meeting to have a PARS brought forward with options and alternatives, questions, pluses and minuses.
Very good.
Just as a for information on that, if you could also bring forward when we talk about PARS what the contract looks like for both OPEB and CalPERS, our contracts with our employees.
Yes.
Just because it would be easier to understand them next to each other.
Absolutely.
But I had a question relative to the special fund categories, and that is that are there staff built into the special funds? Do we pay any staff costs at all out of, like, Carl Moyers? You have a whole list of them.
We do.
Here.
Yes.
How many employees rest on those programs?
I think it's approximately 20. Damien, is that right?
Yeah. Approximately about 8% of our employees, so roughly 20 or so.
Thank you. And the numbers that you showed here in terms of total employee count are inclusive of those employees as well?
That's correct.
Thank you. And are they wholly assigned to those, or is the cost split between general fund and the special funds?
The vast majority of the costs are picked up by the special funds. Those programs pretty much fund those employees to the tune of 95%.
What might be of help just when we take our final vote is to look at our employee count relative to their funding sources. Thank you.
Can I stay with that a minute? Because you said 20 people, but it's you're talking about throughout the whole, because I went immediately to our budget. It's 2 point something.
Well, it's Carol Moyer, TFCA, some of our radio room folks, some of our inspectors, some of the Spare the Air program. So 20 is just what's in SID. They're spread throughout the agency.
Okay. Anything else on this topic? If not, we will go to item number 5, which is proposed amendments to Regulation 3 fees. Mr. Williams. Thank you very much, Mr. McKay. That was excellent, excellent report.
So, Madam Chair, for our fees, our Director of Engineering, Jamie Williams, will give you a presentation. It's the fees are calculated by our engineering staff for the most part, And so it just makes sense for Jamie to give you this presentation.
Okay, thank you. So thank you, Chair Groom, and members of the Budget and Finance Committee. I'm going to give you a presentation on our proposed fee increases for the next fiscal year. I'll talk a little bit about our cost recovery background. You heard some of this in the previous presentation by Dr. McKay. Get into the details on our draft fee amendments. Talk a little bit about the public comments we've received so far, as well as get into our rule development schedule for adoption. So as you saw previously, roughly 47% of our revenue come from our fees associated with our regulatory program. The other large bucket comes from property taxes. And from a cost recovery standpoint, we have the authority to recover 100% of our costs with respect to our regulatory programs. So these are permitting and compliance programs, some of the air monitoring programs as well. We have a general policy to try to recover all of those costs. However, we have not been at that 100% cost recovery level. But back in 2012, the board's direction, we set a policy to try to get to 85% over the course of 4 years, from fiscal year 2013 to fiscal year 2016. And part of that was putting in a standard rate increase to give some certainty to the regulated community on how these fee increases would be applied. So we looked at each individual fee schedules. The fee schedules are typically broken down by the type of equipment that's being permitted, but there are some that are based on emissions or other inputs. And we try to look at, also with respect to cost recovery, ways that we can contain our costs as well. So the trend in cost recovery, if you look starting in fiscal year 2011, we were at 65% with the adoption of the 85% policy, which was fiscal year 2013, we were at 80%, and we have been moving up towards that. And as Dr. McKay mentioned, there are two parts to this percentage, the numerator and the denominator, the numerator being our fees and the denominator being our costs. And so the main driver for our costs are personnel. And so I'll talk a little bit about our personnel and how those costs have gone up on the next slide, but any gaps that we have in these percentages are covered by tax revenue. And so we're projected to be at 82% cost recovery this year, so we still have not gotten to that 85% target or goal yet. So going back again to fiscal year 2011, you can see coming out of the economic downturn, our primary drivers are still personnel. And we have looked at reducing over time, and now we've deferred some of our expenses on capital and services supply. Those are starting to come up to address some of the things that we have not taken care of. But the personnel costs are the main drivers. And so starting, if you even look at fiscal year 2015, where we had 317 filled positions, and you project to where we are proposed to be at now, we're looking at 347 for this fiscal year and going up to 359. And so that's over a 10% increase in personnel costs. And so those increasing personnel costs will lower our overall cost recovery percentage as we take on more programs, more regulations. So we are in the sixth year of our cost recovery policy. We are looking at a rough average of 6.4% fee increase over the fee schedules that we are increasing. We do have some new fees, which I'll talk about, that are tied to Regulation 1118. And that's assuming the adoption of 1118, those fees would go into effect. And we have continued to promote strong involvement with the regulated community, both in this process, but also, as Dr. McKay mentioned, through our next round and updated cost recovery study, which we'll be kicking off this year. So to get into the specifics of some of the proposed fee schedule changes, this map's very similar to what we have done in previous years. So we look on at each individual fee schedule and what percentage of costs we are currently recovering. We tend to look back at a three-year average. And so the schedules where we are recovering 95 to 100% of the costs already, we would be looking at increasing the cost of living, the CPIW,
That is the 2.7%, and you can see the fee schedules affected there. 85 to 95%, 7%, 75 to 85%, 8%, and less than 75%, a 9% increase. So some of the specifics, major stationary source fees and indirect source fees would go up by this 2.7%. We have Schedule F, Schedule G3, miscellaneous sources, and greenhouse gas fees by 7%. And then our GDFs, our gas stations and bulk terminals, as well as major facility reviews fees would go up by 8%. This series of fees going up by 9%. You could read them. I won't list them all or name them all. And then for the fee schedules in which we are at 100% or over 100% projected for the, or calculated for the last 3 years, we are not proposing an increase on those. So that includes Schedule B, which I will call out because that handles all of our engines, boilers, combustion equipment, as well as asbestos operation fees, toxic inventory fees, and our stationary storage. Those are tanks. So as I mentioned, we are currently, and as you're aware, developing Regulation 1118, and this is looking at reducing risk of air toxic pollution from existing facilities. And this will require both for facilities that are above our threshold, the execution of a facility-wide health risk assessment, in which we will formalize the risk threshold level. And if they are above the threshold of 10 in a million, the facility would be required to submit a risk reduction plan to mitigate those risks to get below 10 in a million or to apply, demonstrate they're applying best available control technology for toxics. So we're projecting up to 1,000 facilities, about 10% of our total number of facilities that may be impacted by this rule. And so the significant work is in actually conducting the health risk assessments, the HRAs, and reviewing and evaluating and approving the risk reduction plans. So we're proposing some new fees that would become effective upon adoption of Rule 1118, and they would only be charged with facilities that require the HRA or the risk reduction plan. And these fees are designed to recover 100% of the costs associated with those. This is work that is above and beyond the work that's currently being done by staff. So the risk reduction plan fees range based on the number of sources that are impacted, and that's from $1,500 to $32,000 per facility. So we've done some analysis on what we think it will take to evaluate and approve those plans. We have a couple of other proposed amendments, changes to the fee schedules, increasing our hearing board fees so that we charge for diesel exhaust particulate matter. It's currently not covered, but we're seeing a significant number of cases around that. Changing the way that we calculate our semiconductor fees just to smooth out the calculation. We're also updating our what we call the slope factor around our toxic inventory fees to reflect our current understanding of toxic risks in the Bay Area. And this impacts what we call the AB 2588 program, which is a state's air toxic program that we collect and supply fees for the state. So as I mentioned, we'll have a new fee schedule equal to the risk assessment fee to cover the HRAs for 1118. We have also removed a couple of fees for duplicate permits and registrations as our costs are not significant in that area. We can provide those quickly. We have changed some of the language around to simplify the definitions and terms for health risk screening analysis, as well as corrected some minor typographical errors. So looking at impacts on some of the small businesses, so gas stations, dry cleaners, auto body shops, and backup generators, you can see what these fee increases would potentially look at. So a standard gas station with 10 multi-product nozzles is looking at about a $260 increase to our total annual permit fees of about $3,600 per year. Our dry cleaners, the majority of them are registered now. They fall into that second category. So they're looking at approximately $20 increase, $225 total fee per year. auto bodies a 46 increase, and the backup generators would just see a small increase related to our increase in our renewal processing fees.
Madam Chair?
Sure.
So some of the larger facilities and impacts on those, you can see the annual percentage of permit fee increases at the refineries. They do represent a significant portion of our permitting revenue. And we have a, through state law, a limit that permit fee rates cannot increase by 15% in any given year. So when we do the calculation and we look at what the impacts may be by increasing fee schedule rates, we cap those at 15% if whenever we get above those. So that is part of our process. So you can see in several cases over the years we have hit up against that limit, and we project to do some of that as well this next fiscal year. A couple other facilities, power plants, you can see the proposed increases that have been larger in the past, but as we've become closer to cost recovery around those sources, we're not increasing as quickly. So for public comments, we held an initial workshop on February 22nd. We do mail out a notice to all of our permit fee payers. So that's, as I mentioned, over probably about 10 to 15,000 mailings that go out with that. We have received some initial comments from Steve and Valero, looking for more understanding of how we calculated the 1118 fees. And more information on our cost recovery and our cost containment policies and process. We also received a comment from the American Petroleum and Convenience Store Association. This is regarding the retail gas stations and an understanding of justification for why we were increasing the fees on those sources. So from a schedule standpoint, we are here March 22nd at the Budget and Finance Committee meeting. We would have our two hearings, the first of which would be on the full board on April 19th, and that would just to receive testimony. And then June 21st would be the proposed hearing date for adoption. And these fees would go into effect July 1st if they were adopted in 2017.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Now, Director Mischoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I understand, I'm looking at slide 17. It also impacts slide 18 and 19. But from what I'm hearing, this slide includes if Rule 1118 is passed or it does not.
This does not. So this is their ongoing permit renewal fees.
Okay.
But it does not reflect.
Okay, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Where I'm going with that, this is my first year on Budget and Finance, second, I guess, going through a budget.
Last year.
My understanding is, and I'm looking at your staff report, the proposed fee increases percentage were based, they get higher based on the fewer percentage or lesser percentage, if you will, of what we've been able to recover.
Yes.
Does the Air Board staff look at this every year and it's always part of the budget?
Yes.
Okay. So, and we made an assumption last year, but some organization, whether it's small business or large, if the service provided to them or the fee recovered was still at 85 to 95, that's why it's a 7% increase. I'm just looking at these small business, and I'm sure we've all in our counties had CUPA increases, and the people just came out of the woodworks. I mean, to go from, those are huge increases. Were we too low before? I'm looking at these small businesses, forgetting the gas station at 263, although my father owned a gas station at one time. That 39, 19, and 46, and I'm now going to get a bill for $666. I mean, I know this, we'll hear public testimony. It just seems like a huge increase. And going to the earlier conversation relative to our budget, we're going to have to really separate that out, that they don't think we're increasing these fees so that we can meet this budget, although we all know that is there. These are huge fees. And if we looked at this last year, is there any understanding or explanation that can be given when we do have these public hearings of what happened from 1617 to 1718 that we had to have such huge increases? What happened?
Well, for one thing, Director Mischoff, for many, many years, we didn't raise fees.
Well, and that was my question. I thought he said we did every year look at this, and we haven't raised fees.
For a long time, though, we didn't raise fees at all. And I want to say 6-7 years ago, we began the public hearing process for a fee-raising plan so that it wouldn't all occur in 1 year, but it would occur gradually. And that's when we made the determination that we would have the 85% of fees maximum. So we have been gradually increasing, but after many years, didn't increase.
And I thank you for that. That's why maybe I'm not making it clear. Last year there were fee increases.
Yes.
So let's just look at the dry cleaner registered. You said that one isn't as big of a jump for them from 19. So we didn't increase whatever those fees incur. Encompass last year? That's what I'm trying to get at. I heard him say we did increase fees last year. I get that there's a policy, but if
yeah, so in general, we have increased fees, our fee rates, over the last several years, at least during the time when I've been here, and adoption of that policy. So that what we've tried to focus on with that is that was an average over the course of the fee schedule of around 6.4%. So we've tried to set the expectation that we do need to raise fees in order to reach our cost recovery process policy. We are looking at them on the individual fee schedules to figure out what the appropriate rate is. And so in the case where we look back every year and say, over the last 3 years, what is our cost recovery percentage on this type of business or equipment, that really drives whether or not we're looking at typically between a 6% and a 9% increase, or just cost of living in some cases.
Let me add a little bit to that, if I may. When we first began the cost recovery program, we were very concerned about the small businesses, especially the dry cleaners, especially the mom-and-pop paint shop, the mom-and-pop muffler repair shop. We were really worried about that. But we also took a look at that time about the cost of inspection, the cost of repeat infractions, and we had kind of a spreadsheet at that time of what it actually cost to service some of these, and we used that as a basis for raising. And we started out with lower raises. A couple years we went to higher raises, but it is expensive, and it is a burden to small business, but they also, in many ways, create a burden for the public, and we feel we have to monitor that.
Yeah, I don't dispute that.
So I just wanted to give you a little history.
But let's be honest. I've been paying $39 a year. I've been paying $19 a year. Somehow there were fee increases. Are you saying that those that are affected were not?
Yeah. I can try to clarify that. Yeah, so the $39 on this slide of the $19, that is the proposed increase for this year. That would bring their total fee to...
I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
it's in dark blue. I didn't see that. I thought that was what they were currently paying.
No, I apologize for not making that clear. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, then. That would have negated all my questions.
That's okay. Director Canepa?
That looks better. I'm looking here.
Director Canepa?
Jamie, quick question for you. Thank you for your presentation. I want to talk about the 2.7 increase for the major stationary source fees. Jamie, is that enough, or could we go farther on that? Does staff feel comfortable with that 2.7%, or give me a little perspective of where you're at on that?
So most of this schedule is focused around our Title V program and where we are in terms of cost recovery on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, based on our cost recovery percentage, this is in line with how we've been affecting the other policies. Affecting or raising the other fee schedules. So we do feel comfortable with that at this point in time. We have been implementing some streamlining policies, particularly around Title V facilities. These are our major stationary sources, and we're continuing to look at ways to improve upon that. But it's something that we would definitely expect to reconsider every year.
Jamie, I think Mr. Broadbent.
Yeah, yeah. Just to also, because we speak in our own speak, Jamie, Title V, we have about 100 of them in the Bay Area, and they include the 5 refineries, of course, but also the power plants, the cement facility, a lot of metal melting operations, just basically anything that's really big has what we call a federal Title V.
Federal, and it's a sort of an additional title permitting process, a program, federal program on top of our regional or localized permitting that we handle. So as Mr. Broadbent said, it represents about 100 facilities. The renewal cycle on those is every 5 years as opposed to every year. There are some amendments and revisions, but right now we do feel like this 2.7% increase is appropriate for this year.
So you feel comfortable with that, Mr. Broadbent?
Director Canepa, yes. So what we do is we take a look at all of our spreadsheets with regard to the staffing time on all this. That's what actually forms the basis of all the fee increases, by the way, in the schedules. And we've been doing that even prior to Prop 26, I think was the number that started this whole process. And to answer your question, we feel pretty comfortable. It's one in which it does represent the lower one. I understand that. And this is what the board has grappled with, because I think the concern has always been about the smaller sources, which the staff shares that concern. And you'd think with a major source, they can afford a bigger increase. But we just take a look at our staff time and just base it on that.
Because I was just wondering, we had a speaker earlier, but I was just wondering if the increase, if we wanted to increase that to 5%, we could do that, correct? That's within our, could we do that, Mr. Munger?
Yes, we could, so long as the costs that are attributable to that aren't less than that 5% increase.
Okay.
Yeah.
Director Hudson.
If you can go to slide 18, Jamie, I'm just looking for clarification. You have, there's an annual percent permit fee increase. It says 13.1%. Now, the 2.7% is different than this, part of this?
So that the 2.7% is just one. There for the two things that actually go into the increase in fees every year. So one can be an increase in activity level. And then there's the increase in the rates.
The point I'm making is that 2.7 isn't the only fee they're paying.
Correct.
We're looking at a big picture here.
Correct.
The other thing, a statement was made, and I'm trying to get this ready for the full board when they look at it. I think Dr. McKay said standard lasts several years. Also being in real estate, that's one of the things I really watch. There is no such thing as standard anymore. It's all negotiable. My recollection was we were trying to get to 85% as a goal. We were there. We got there. Then you had a bad budget and finance chair, and it went down because we added 10 people. I'm taking the heat off you, Carol. The reason I'm saying is I want to be careful. Is we got there doing everything right to 85%. Then we added people, and it dropped, and we're trying to get back there. I can see where the public comes in and said, okay, we get back to 85, you do something else, we got to do it again. I'm sharing the same concern out loud that I'm kind of hearing from people here today. That's 7, 8, and 9. I mean, once you get over 6, I get scared. So I don't know where they are. Just be forewarned, it's probably going to pop up at the full board.
Director Chavez.
Thank you. First of all, I wanted to thank you for doing so much outreach to the small businesses. I think that was just really appreciated. And interestingly, we didn't have as many people engaged as I thought. So, but I wanted to say thank you for reaching out. As part of your process. The second thing I wanted to make sure I understood is when this comes to the full board, the method that we use for cost recovery is actually pretty important as one just transparency slide and picture. And I think the point that that Mr. What's Hudson just raised, what's his name? What's his trouble? Just raised around the elements that go into that is actually pretty important and relatively simple, but important to be able to explain. And then lastly, a question. When we look at the policy as we look at cost recovery impact at all penalties?
No, I just took some, but I think I'm
No, we don't consider penalties as part of that.
And so when the penalties are considered, what goes into determining whether or not the penalty amounts change?
Director Chavez, we generally collect around $2 to $3 million per year in penalties, but it isn't something we count on. It isn't something built into our. I mean, it's we do try to budget. I think 2.2.
I did see that in the budget. What 2. I'm asking 7. Is how are they reconsidered or considered?
Oh,
and okay. What's the timing? I was just wondering if it was already built into a policy.
Penalties are set according to state law.
Thank
so
you.
So there isn't
There's
a board
no local,
action.
Okay.
There's
thank no, you.
Yeah. Director Mylan.
Yeah. Thanks. On slide 14, could you just go there? So I'm curious if the risk reduction plan fees are going to range from $1,500 to $32,000. Can you give me an example of a $1,500, an example of a $32,000?
So $1,500 might be a gas station, retail gas station. It would be a large retail gas station. So it would be Costco or Safeway, typically, here in the Bay Area. And a $32,000 facility would be a refinery. And this is just for the risk reduction plan.
And we're not acting on that just yet.
No, I think we're looking at May.
Yes, Director Miley. I'll just give you a little bit of a heads up that we're thinking that will likely be brought to you in July, only because there's a practical reality of just too many things on the agenda for the May board meeting. But I did want to clarify if the board, for whatever reason, does not adopt 1118, the fees don't get implemented. So we've actually done that before where we'll put together a fee schedule for you. You'll adopt it as part of the budgetary cycle, and it's in reference to a proposed rule. But for whatever reason, that proposed rule doesn't come to fruition, and so we don't actually end up collecting the fee. So that is actually a little it's a little confusing, but it's just part of how we do things.
I got it. Go to slide 17. So if I'm a gas station and we adopt the risk reduction plan, will I now have $1,500 and $3,600? So will I be at $5,000?
So if you are a gas station, and we have about 2,400 gas stations, retail gas stations, and your toxic risk is above 10 in a million, without getting into too much detail, that's our threshold, then you would be required to pay for a health risk assessment, facility-wide health risk assessment, and the risk reduction plan. And so you would see the $1,500 fee, and there would also be a fee associated with the risk reduction plan, so it would be on top of that.
Yeah.
And this year, those health risk assessment fees and risk reduction fees are a one-time thing, so it would not be an annual
so
ongoing.
So that'll be a one-time. All right. I'll have to see how that plays out, but I just wanted to understand that. Even though it's one time, I just wanted to try to get a sense of that. Okay.
How many facilities?
There is concern. And to put it in context for the retail gas stations, they're probably, we've broken that out into a separate category for 1118 implementation, similar with the backup diesel generators.
Yeah, and I'm just using that as an example because, the range is 1,500 to 32,000, so. I'm concerned about everybody who might be exposed to this, but we'll just play that out when you get it to us. Okay.
I don't have the exact number in front of me, but there are roughly 200, probably 10% of the gas stations will need to at least go through screening prioritization
and will we
process.
Be, I'm sorry to keep speaking, but will we be looking to try to impose that all at once?
It would come. There's essentially a period of over the course of a year, so we typically conduct the health risk assessment, look at the results, and then there's a period of time for the facility to prepare a plan for risk reduction. So it may be within the same year, it may fall over the course of 2 years. It depends on the complexity of the facility and the timing.
Okay.
I don't know if you all remember this, but it was several hearings ago when the board heard us talk about this proposed rule, and you all didn't want to have the facilities themselves prepare the HRA. You said the district ought to prepare it. So that's what you see here.
Director Mischoff.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Miley, because that brought up another question and the answer. You said it's a one-time fee, but, okay, a health risk assessment is done. Then they come up with a risk reduction plan. Don't we have to monitor that to make sure there won't be costs associated with that each year? Or is it already built in and you just assume,
So those
I'm concerned about the one-time cost.
Yeah, it's a one-time to prepare the plan, and then they're going to be implementing that plan, and that's built into the engineering time and the enforcement time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Williams. Are there any other questions for Mr. Williams? Thank you very much. Item number six, committee member comments or other business. Okay. The time and place of our next meeting is Wednesday, April the 26th at 9:30 in this room. Thank you all very much.